capacity. Every room was booked at high season rates, and along the front row on Honeymoon Bay, it was all return guests, the ones Estella calls the patronage. Mr. and Mrs. Very Important of Park Avenue. The Big Deal family from Lake Forest, Illinois. The New Moneys from La Jolla. I recognized them, and yes, I called them by their real names, Mr. and Mrs. Vikram, the Caruso family, the Burlingames. Their eyes lit up when they saw me, but I always reintroduce myself just in case. Oh, yes, Rosie, how are you? Wonderful to see you again. How has your year been? I said my year had been good, though nothing was further from the truth. But there was no way I could tell the New Moneys about my excruciating breakup with Oscar, and how disappointing that had been, because he'd promised me that once he got out of jail, he would work in a legitimate business, maybe even get a job alongside me at Keneal. But instead, he was back to selling drugs to people on the cruise ships. I didn't complain that I was still living at home with my mother and Huck. The returning guests, the patronage, loved coming back and seeing a familiar face because it made Keneal feel like home. It made it feel like a private club where they were members. For me, it was primarily a business relationship. The tips were double what they would have been with complete strangers. In most cases, anyway. The guests at Keneal are 95% white. There are a few Japanese here and there. A couple of rich South American businessmen, rum, casinos, and the occasional Black American couple or Indian family. So when Oscar came in for drinks with Borneo and Little Jay, they stuck out. They wore baseball hats on backward, heavy gold chains, those ridiculous jeans that drooped in the ass. Estella saw Oscar first. She came over while I was at the bar getting cocktails for a trio of pasty white gentlemen who had just anchored their enormous yacht out in front of the resort, and she said, "Oscar here, rosy girl, with his clownish friends." "Send him away," I said. "I wish I could, rosy girl, but they're paying customers just like the rest." "Keep them out of my section." "Oscar asked for you."
"All the more reason."
"Okay, I'll give them to Tessie." I loathed Tessie, so this was killing two birds. I dropped the drinks off with a yacht gentleman. Yacht gentleman one was tall and bald with a posh English accent and what I knew to be a $40,000 Patek Philippe. I'd picked up some useless knowledge on this job. Yacht gentleman two had dark, slicked back hair and such distracting good looks that I nicknamed him James Bond in my mind. Yacht Gentleman 3 was a doughy Midwesterner with silvering hair. I knew he was Midwestern because he stood up and introduced himself.
"Russell Steele," he said, "Iowa City."
His manners caught me off guard. Normally, men like the ones he was with either ignored me, made a pass at me, or snapped their fingers so I would move faster. They did not stand up and offer their names like they were crashing a party and I was the hostess. And thank goodness they didn't. On an average holiday weekend night, I had over 100 customers. How could I possibly remember them all? "Rosie Small," I said. "Pleasure." I had already forgotten his last name, but I did retain his first name, Russell, and Iowa City, because the place sounded so American, or what I always thought of as American. Iowa City evoked cows in pastures, silos, corner drugstores where kids bought malted milkshakes, church socials, marching bands, and grown men wearing overalls. "Enjoy your drinks. Let me know if you're interested in ordering food. The conch fritters are very good."
"Conch fritters, then," Russell from Iowa City said. "I'm not sure what they are, but if you say they're good, I'm up for trying them. In fact, bring two orders. That okay with you guys?"
The other two gentlemen were poring over a sheaf of papers printed with columns of figures. James Bond looked up.
Yeah, Russ, get whatever you want. Bring some sushi, too, you pick. Enough for three, please."
James Bond handed me his Amex Centurion card and said,
"Start us a tab, doll."
I wanted to tell James Bond that I was not a doll, I was a person.
but I figured I'd get back at him by ordering the most expensive sushi on the menu, sashimi, tuna tataki, hamachi, unagi. I could see poor Russell looking very uncomfortable, like he wanted to stick up for me but didn't know how. He was, quite clearly, low man on the totem pole of this particular triumvirate, as he had neither the flashy watch nor the movie star good looks, nor the centurion card. He might have been the brother-in-law of one or the other, a sister's husband whom they had brought along to the Caribbean as a favor or because they lost a bet. He didn't know what conch fritters were. I went to the register to put in an order for the fritters and $200 worth of sushi. I could have doubled that. James Bond wasn't the kind of man to complain about his bill or even check it, and studied the name on the Centurion card. Todd Croft. It was a solid whitewashed name, symmetrical and masculine, like the real name of a secret superhero, Clark Kent, Peter Parker. I wondered if it was made up. I didn't care as long as the card worked, which it did. I kept tabs on Oscar out of my peripheral vision. He ordered a bottle of Dom Perignon, which Tessie made a big production of carrying out in front of her, label displayed, like she was one of those chicks on a game show giving away the grand prize. The pop of the cork cut through all the chatter, and the restaurant quieted so that I could clearly hear Harry Belafonte singing, "Yes, we have no bananas." People whispered and sneaked glances at Oscar, and I yearned to tell them to stop. Couldn't they see that was what he was after? I then watched the big deal family's daughter, Lucinda Caruso, who has made sure to tell me every year for the past 3 years that she recently graduated from Harvard, which I take to mean that she has yet to find a job, a theory reinforced by the fact that she signed every charge to her father's room, approach Oscar's table, and proceed to take the fourth seat. Lucinda was wearing a very short sequined cocktail dress that would have been better at an event where she remained standing. I overheard her say, "Are you guys rap stars?" I rolled my eyes, not only because Lucinda was feeding the beast, but also because she probably couldn't imagine a black man having the money to order Dom unless he was a rap star or a professional athlete. I could have shut her up by telling her the truth. "He sells drugs, Lucinda." But it was none of my business. The yacht gentleman's food was up. I set one order of conch fritters, piping hot, golden brown, and fragrant, served with a papaya cayenne aioli, in front of Russell from Iowa City. This is my favorite part of the job, other than the money, introducing the Caribbean to people who have never experienced it. I plunked the tower of sushi. The way Chef had arranged it was quite impressive, and the fish was so plump and fresh, it looked like art, in front of Todd Croft. "There you go, doll," I said. "Enjoy." Russell from Iowa City barked out a laugh so surprised and genuine that I gave him a wink. The night progressed. It was busy. I kept one eye on the yachtmen. After all that, they barely touched the sushi, and one eye on Oscar and his friends. Lucinda stayed at the table. They ordered another bottle of Dom. Mr. and Mrs. Big Deal stopped by the table and tried to entice Lucinda to go with them to the Chateau Bordeaux, but she refused to leave, and the second her parents were out the door, she rose from her chair and sat on Oscar's lap. At that point, I turned away. I knew Oscar was showboating just to goad me into reconsidering my decision. But I hadn't done all my soul-searching only to cave because I couldn't stand to see him with a silly rich girl on his lap. I tended to my other tables. I was even nice to Tessie. When I saw her heading out with a third bottle of Dom, I said, "Tonight is your lucky night. Oscar is an excellent tipper." Around 10, things started to quiet down. Two of the yachtmen, Todd Croft and the tall, bald Brit, left, and Russell from Iowa City moved to the bar and planted himself in front of the television to watch a basketball game. When I checked the screen, I saw Iowa was playing Northwestern. I went up to him because I had a minute,
and also because Todd Croft had left an even $500 for a $320 check. "You're rooting for Iowa?" I asked.
"Northwestern, actually," he said. "My alma mater."
Ah. I knew more about football than basketball, and nearly all my basketball knowledge was limited to the San Antonio Spurs in general, and Tim Duncan in particular, because he hailed from St. Croix, and some of my small cousins had actually played a pickup game with him once on the courts in Content. But it was best I changed the subject. "So, your friends left you behind?"
"They went into Cruz Bay," Russell said, "looking for women."
He held up his left hand.
"I'm married, with two boys."
"Well, your wife is a very lucky woman," I said, and I patted his shoulder. "Your next drink is on me. How did you like the conch fritters?"
"I loved them," he said. "I was meaning to ask if you knew a place I could get some real Caribbean food. I have the day to myself tomorrow, and I want to explore."
"Well," I said, "if you want local flavor, go to the East End. There's a place called Vi's on Hanson Bay." He took a pen out of his shirt pocket and pulled a cocktail napkin off the stack.
"Vi's?"
"She makes a mean garlic chicken and the best Johnny cakes," I said. "For a few dollars, you can rent a chaise on her beach."
"Is there shade?"
Russell from Iowa City asked. He held out a pale, freckled arm, and I thought, this poor guy, God bless him. "There's shade," I said. "Here, I'll draw you a map." I clocked out at 11, sorted my tips, marveling at my windfall from Todd Croft, and decided that I would stop by the Ocean Grill at Mongo's for a drink on my way home. I headed past the sugar mill on my way to the parking lot and stopped to say hello to my wild donkeys, Stop, Drop, and Roll. They always looked a little eerie at night, more like ghost horses than white donkeys, and the backdrop of the stone ruins of the sugar mill only heightened the otherworldly effect. But I thought of these three like pets. They rarely wandered off the grounds of Keneal, and I couldn't ignore them. In retrospect, I should have realized that Oscar knew this. He jumped out of the shadows and grabbed my arm. "Baby," I gasped, though I wasn't exactly surprised. A part of me knew there was no way he'd left. I had already planned to turn on the flashlight of my phone and sweep the back of my car before I climbed in. "Let me go, Oscar." He held tight. I checked behind him for Borneo or Little Jay or even Lucinda Caruso, but there was no one on the path in either direction. If I screamed, Woodrow or one of the other security guards would hear me and escort Oscar off the property. But the last thing I wanted was everyone all up in my business. As soon as it got out that Oscar had shown up at the restaurant and made trouble, my mother would hear about it and somehow twist it into being my fault. She would say that I had led Oscar on or had acted recklessly by walking to my car by myself. Oscar didn't let go. He pulled me to him so close that I could smell the champagne on his breath.
"I need you to come back, baby."
I said, "We've been over this, Oscar. I'm not changing my mind."
"You got another man then? That brother from Christiansted?"
He was talking about Bryson, a guy I'd gone out with a few times in college. Bryson lived on St. Croix. "It's none of your business, Oscar." I succeeded in reclaiming my arm. "I'm tired. I'm going home. Good night." I turned around. "And you know that if you come anywhere near the house, Leanne will call the police and you'll go right back to jail."
Oscar said, "I'm going to Christiansted tomorrow to kill that brother."
I stopped in my tracks. Had anyone else said something like that, I would have scoffed. But what had landed Oscar in jail was stabbing his friend Leon for borrowing his Ducati without permission. "You'll do no such thing," I said.
"Try me," Oscar said.
Then he suddenly dropped the tough guy act and sounded like himself.
"Rosie, try me."
"Why can't you just leave me alone?" I said. "Why do you come here when you know I'm working? There are 10 other places you and your friends can hang out. Why come to Keneal?
Because you want me to know you have the money to order Dom Perignon? I don't care. You want me to see that girls throw themselves at you? I care even less. I loved you when I was a girl, 15, 16, 17. But I'm a woman now, Oscar, and I'm moving on.
Baby, Oscar said, and he grabbed the strap of my purse.
Get off me, I said.
I put a hand against the unyielding muscles of his chest.
Stop bothering the lady.
Both Oscar and I turned to see who jogging toward us. Russell from Iowa City, that's who. Oscar laughed, and I thought, oh, dear Lord, no. It was probably a Midwestern thing to defend a woman's honor, but it would end in disaster for Russell from Iowa City. I would have to call out for Woodrow after all.
What you gonna do about it?
Oscar said. He kissed his teeth.
You gonna stop me?
To his credit, Russell from Iowa City did not appear even a little afraid. He looked serious and disappointed, as though he were an assistant principal who had found his favorite student misbehaving and a suspension was coming.
Yes, Russell said coolly. I'm going to stop you. Rosie, are you heading home? Can I escort you to your car?
I tried to give him a look that said he didn't have to defend me and he shouldn't defend me because the consequences would be dire. Oscar would beat him to a pulp, or maybe just hit him once, or maybe just humiliate him. But whatever course of action Oscar took, it wouldn't be worth it. I could handle Oscar. Russell from Iowa City most certainly could not. Russell held out his arm like an old-fashioned gentleman caller. I sighed and hoped that maybe, just maybe, Oscar would be more afraid of violating his parole than of being shown up. I linked my arm through Russell's. From there, things happened fast. Oscar pushed Russell from behind, and Russell let go of my arm and grabbed the front of Oscar's shirt, and they tussled while I searched the shadows for Woodrow on his golf cart. Where was he? And then, the next thing I knew, Russell from Iowa City had Oscar in a death grip, and Oscar was gasping for air. It looked like Russell was about to snap his neck, and I found myself fearing that Russell was going to kill Oscar instead of vice versa.
Now,
Russell said in a calm but disappointed assistant principal voice,
I'm going to let you go. But you are to leave Rosie alone. Do you understand me?
Oscar choked out an affirmative, and Russell tightened his grip so that Oscar squeaked like a chew toy. It's okay, I said. Thank you. Russell let Oscar go. Oscar buckled at the knees, stumbled a few yards away, and bent over in the grass, turning his neck to be sure it still worked. Russell offered me his arm again.
Where did you learn to do that?
I asked him once we were safely at my car.
My father was a Navy man, Russell said.
I stood on my tiptoes and kissed his cheek.
My hero, I said.
The next day, almost without thinking, I drove to the East End to Miss Vi's at Hanson Bay. I was like a woman possessed because there was no good reason to go all the way out to that side of the island. Normally, if I wanted to go to the beach, I parked at the National Park Service sign and hiked down to Solomon Bay. But I somehow convinced myself that on the Saturday of the holiday weekend, even Solomon would be overrun and that the only way to escape the crowds would be to go to Hanson Bay. Besides which, now that it was in my head, I couldn't shake my craving for Miss Vi's garlic chicken and Johnny Cakes. I told myself it had nothing to do with Russell from Iowa City. I wasn't attracted to him, or I hadn't been until the incident with Oscar. But having one's honor defended is a mighty aphrodisiac. Still, Russell was old enough to be my father. I now know he's 45, more than double my age. But that, in a way, was also attractive, because what I was looking for was someone older, someone responsible and stable, someone adult. Oscar was older than me by 7 years, but emotionally he was a little boy who had a bone to pick with everyone. I wore my white bikini and a white t-shirt knotted at the midriff and a pair of white denim shorts. White was my color. There was a line of cars, all rentals, parked along the road near Vi's. There was no telling if one of them was Russell's, or if he'd taken a taxi, or if he was even there at all. The East End was a hike from everywhere, and he might have decided to go fishing with his buddies or cruise over to the BVI's for lunch at Foxy's. The second I stepped onto the beach and scanned the chaises in the shade, I saw him, settled back with a rum punch in hand. When he spotted me, he smiled. And by smiled, I mean he beamed like I was the only person in the world he wanted to see. "Rosie," he said. We hugged and he kissed my cheek, and it was like seeing a friend, even though I barely knew him. He called over Flora, whom he already knew by name, and said he would pay for a second chaise, and Flora waved a hand and says, "Rosie don't need to pay, she's family." Which was actually true. Flora and Vi were second cousins of my father, Levi Small, and for that reason, they didn't speak to my mother, so I didn't need to worry about news of me visiting a white gentleman out at Hanson Bay getting back to her. I ordered a Coke because I had to work at 5, and Russ ordered another rum punch, and then together we ordered garlic chicken with rice and beans and Johnny cakes. We stuffed our faces and we talked. I told Russ the long story of my relationship with Oscar, and then he told me that he was down in the Virgin Islands because he had been offered a job with a hedge fund that was owned and operated by Todd Croft, whom he had known during his college years. "At Northwestern?" I said, proud of myself for remembering.
"Todd flunked out freshman year, but he hung around Winnetka, and we had some business dealings."
I laughed. "Business dealings? At 18? Russ sighed.
"I haven't even told my wife this story."
"What?"
"Todd had a contact who wanted to sell alcohol to underclassmen in the dorm. My sophomore year, I was an RA, resident advisor, and in exchange for me looking the other way, Todd gave me a cut of his profits."
"Russ," I said, "I wouldn't have pegged you as a criminal."
"We never got caught," Russ said. "I have a trustworthy face, I guess."
"So I take it Todd has moved on from the smuggling business?" I said.
"High finance," Russ said, "and I mean high. Todd is an impressive guy, though. He got a job working in one of those boiler rooms, calling people cold and encouraging them to invest money, and now his hedge fund is worth nearly $3 billion.
"No wonder you're going to work for him," I said. "What an opportunity."
"For the past 17 years, I've worked for the Corn Refiners Association," Russ said. "But the pay is peanuts, and my wife, Irene, is unhappy. She keeps a stiff upper lip. She's from some pretty hardy Scandinavian stock, but I can tell she thinks I'm a failure. And most days, I'm pretty sure she thinks about leaving me."
"Oh my God," I said. "She would have to be crazy to think about leaving you." He stared at me a second with a look of utter amazement, and something changed between us then. I felt equal parts terrible and triumphant about it, but terrible won out, and I didn't even stay for a swim. I plunked down $10 for the food, offered Russ my hand, and said, "I wish all visitors to our fair island were like you, Russ. Thank you for your help with Oscar. I will forever be grateful." Russ held my hand and said,
"Stay a little longer, can you?"
"Sorry," I said. "I have some things to take care of before work." My words were rushed, and I tripped over a tree root as I hurried off the beach, but I had to get out of there before I crossed a line. Though I knew a line had already been crossed. I had sought him out, worn my sexiest outfit, and said the words that I knew he needed to hear. I would like to say this was unwitting, but working in the service industry has given me keen people skills. I could tell that Russell from Iowa City was a people pleaser, and that his wife, Irene, made him feel like a disappointment, and that hearing me say he was the opposite would all but make him fall in love. He was married. Irene was waiting for him back home in Iowa. There were women on St. John, Tessie among them, who thought nothing of sleeping with men who were here on vacation. Tessie routinely had one-night stands with gentlemen who were staying at Keneal by themselves, That was one of the reasons I disliked her. I was not going to sleep with Russell from Iowa City. And yet, when I got to work at 5 o'clock and noticed the yacht was gone, I felt something like sorrow. My hero had left, and I couldn't remember his last name. I would never see him again. So imagine my surprise when, at 7 o'clock, as the hibiscus pink ball of the sun was sinking into the water, and Lucinda Caruso was shooting me a smug glance from the table where her Harvard-educated ass was sitting with her big-deal parents, a look that I could only assume meant that she had slept with Oscar after all, poor girl. Russ walked across the beach and into the restaurant. I blinked, wondering if it was a trick of the blinding light of the sun just before it set, but then he waved at me and I hurried over. "I thought you left," I said. "The yacht..."
"Todd and Stephen headed over to Virgin Gorda," Russ said. "They have business. I told them I wanted to stay here and mull over their offer. They're coming back Monday to pick me up."
"Stay here on St. John?" I said. I was so happy that he wasn't gone forever that I wasn't quite following.
"At Keneal," Russ said.
He pulled a key out of his pocket.
"Hawk's Nest room."
"How did you manage that?" I asked. "I thought we were full."
"I put the general manager in a headlock," he said.
We laughed. I said, "I'd put you in my section, but you'll probably be more comfortable at the bar."
He said, "Bar is fine, but I'll miss you bringing me my conch fritters."
I said, "If you think I'm going to let someone else bring you your conch fritters, you're crazy." He gave me a look then that was so long and deep, my legs grew weak and my face grew hot, and never in my life had I been more aware that I was a human being, powerful and fallible. Part 2. Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Irene. She drives Cash and Winnie to the airport in Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, they will fly to Chicago, and from Chicago to St. Thomas. Irene is tempted to tell Cash that she received her own job offer on St. John, but he's so excited about getting back down there that Irene decides not to steal his thunder or distract from his anticipation. Besides, she isn't at all sure Huck was serious. Still, it was nice to hear his voice. Cash's departure turns out to be the impetus Irene needs to get things done. On the way home from Cedar Rapids, she calls Ed Sorley.
"Oh, Irene," he says, "you must have read my mind. I just dug up a photocopy of the check that Russ gave me when we closed on the Church Street house. Turns out it was a cashier's check drawn on a bank called SGMT in the Cayman Islands."
"The Cayman Islands?" Irene says, "not the Virgin Islands?"
"The Cayman Islands," Ed says. "I double-checked that myself."
"But it cleared, right?" Irene says. "We did actually pay for the house?"
"Yes, yes," Ed says. "I'll try to see if maybe this SGMT has a phone number or a website, but even if it does, it might be difficult to track down. It's a cashier's check, which is almost like Russ showed up at the bank with 600 grand in cash. But that's obviously impossible."
"Is it, though?" Irene wonders.
"He might have an account at this bank," Ed says. "I'll try to figure it out."
"Thank you, Ed," Irene says. She hangs up and calls Paulette Vickers. Paulette is out of the office. Is Paulette ever in the office? Irene wonders. And so Irene leaves a voicemail. "Paulette, it's Irene Steele," she says. "I need a copy of Russ's death certificate. I can't do anything without it. My attorney said that until it's issued, Russ is technically still alive." Irene gives a weak laugh and flashes back to her dream about the chickens. "So if you would please send me 10 certified copies, I would greatly appreciate it. That's apparently what I need. You have my address, and if there's a fee, I'm happy to send a check, or maybe you can take it out of your operating account for the villa." Irene pauses. "Thank you, Paulette. If this is an issue, please call me back." Irene hangs up and thinks, please don't call me back. Just send the death certificate.
Paulette's husband, Douglas Vickers, was the one who identified Russ's body and delivered his ashes to Irene. He's her only hope of getting this documentation. She feels a small sense of accomplishment, really small, because she has learned nothing except that Russ apparently had a relationship with a bank in the Cayman Islands. Irene doesn't have the foggiest idea where the Cayman Islands are. If she were to visit, would she find that Russ also has a mistress and child there? She laughs at the absurdity of the thought, and yet it's not out of the question. The road home from the airport brings Irene perilously close to the offices of the magazine Heartland Home and Style, her place of employment. Irene hasn't been to work in 3 weeks. She has two voicemails from Mavis Key on her cell phone. In the second of these, Mavis announced that she did a little detective work and learned that Millie had passed away, which, Mavis assumed, was the reason for Irene's extended absence. Mavis offered her condolences, then asked if Irene would prefer the magazine to send flowers or donate to a particular cause. Irene had ignored the message. She didn't want to think about work. But she can't ignore it forever. Impulsively, Irene turns into the parking lot of the magazine and pulls into her spot. Already the signage has been changed to read Executive Editor. She cuts the engine and checks her appearance in the rearview. Her hair is braided, her bangs long but not ratty. She's not wearing any makeup, but she still has a little bit of color on her nose and across her cheeks from the sun in St. John. In she goes. The first person she sees is the magazine's receptionist, Dolores. Dolores decorates the reception desk herself using the magazine's small slush fund. She follows the lead of all the major retailers and really gets a jump on things. Now that Christmas and New Year's are behind them, Dolores has her area decked out for Valentine's Day. There's an arrangement of red and white carnations on the desk and, next to that, an enormous bowl of candy hearts.
Irene! Dolores shrieks.
She leaps out of her chair and comes running to give Irene a maternal embrace. Dolores has 5 children, 17 grandchildren, a pillowy bosom, and soft, downy cheeks. Irene allows herself to be swallowed up in Dolores's arms, and soon the rest of the staff, bored or easily distracted, even though they should be hard at work on the April issue, come trooping out, all filled with joy, or maybe just relief, at Irene's unexpected return.
Happy New Year! We've missed you! Is everything okay? We've been so worried. It's not like you to take unscheduled time off. We knew something must be wrong. We heard about your promotion, and then Mavis gave us the news about Millie. God bless you, Irene. She was so lucky to have a daughter-in-law like you.
Betts, from advertising, says,
How's Russ handling it?
At this, Irene separates herself by an arm's length. She can't lie, but neither can she tell them the truth. She says,
Is Mavis in her office? I really need to talk with her.
Yes, yes, Mavis is in her office. Dolores takes it upon herself to personally escort Irene up the half flight of stairs to Mavis's office, which happens to be right next door to Irene's own office, the door of which is shut tight. Dolores raps on Mavis's door, then swings it open and announces,
Irene is here,
as though Irene is the First Lady of Iowa. Irene steps in. Mavis is on the phone. Dolores whispers,
Mavis is always on the phone.
As if this is Irene's first time in the office, her first time meeting Mavis.
She shouldn't be long. I'll give you to your privacy.
And she closes the door. Mavis is wearing a silk pantsuit in what must be considered winter white. She's not wearing a blouse under the blazer, though Irene spies a peak of lacy camisole. In an office where most of the employees are women, and most of those women wear embroidered sweaters or Eileen Fisher schmatas, Mavis is a curiosity indeed. Mavis raises a finger,
1 minute,
then lowers a palm, please sit. She has decorated her office in eggshell suede and black leather, an aesthetic previously frowned upon as modern and urban by the executives at Heartland Home and Style. Irene helps herself to one of the Italian sparkling waters in Mavis's glass-fronted mini-fridge. Why not enjoy the pretensions that are on offer? She decides to remain standing. Mavis says, "Thanks for your help with this, Bernie. I'll circle back next week." She hangs up. "Irene?" "Mavis," Irene says. She turns back to make sure that the office door is closed and that Dolores isn't stationed outside with her ear to the glass. "I need to talk to you. Can I trust you to keep what we say confidential?" The question is rhetorical. Mavis doesn't trade on gossip like the other people in the office, because Mavis has invested only her head here, not her heart. She was hired to be a problem solver and a moneymaker. She's an ice queen, which, under the present circumstances, is a tremendous asset. Irene lets it all out as concisely as possible. Russ has been killed in a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands. Irene's trip down to St. John with the boys revealed evidence of a second life, an expensive villa, a mistress, also dead, a 12-year-old daughter. Russ's body was identified and cremated before Irene arrived. Russ's boss, Todd Croft, the apparent puppet master of this whole grotesque theater, can't be reached, and the business's website is down.
I'm speechless, Mavis says. Your husband is dead? He had a secret life?
Irene blinks.
I'm sure you don't want to go into the gritty details. Who can blame you? But, wow, I thought maybe you were angry about your new role here.
Oh, I was, Irene says. But then all this happened and... She studies the bottle of fancy water in her hands because it gives her something to do other than cry.
Irene, Mavis says, what can I do to help?
I'm giving you my notice, Irene says. I can't come back to work. I thought maybe with time, but no, Irene sighs. I'm not even sure I'll stay in Iowa City.
What? Mavis says, what about your house?
Irene shrugs. 3 weeks ago, leaving behind the house would have been unthinkable. That house took 6 years of her life to complete. It's a work of art. Now, of course, Irene sees how blindly devoted she was to the project, how she sweated over the details and completely ignored her marriage. It's entirely possible that Irene had been standing at her workspace in the kitchen, pouring over 4 choices of wallpaper for the 3rd upstairs bath, and Russ had come to her and said, "Honey, I have a lover in the Virgin Islands, and I've fathered a daughter." And Irene had said, "That's great, honey." What Russ did was wrong, but Irene is not blameless.
"You know, I've been to St. John," Mavis says. "I stayed at the Westin with my parents. It's beautiful."
"I'd like you to pass my resignation on to Joseph," Irene says. "I'll call him myself eventually, but right now," Mavis waves a hand,
"I got it. Consider it handled."
"And would you smooth things over with the rest of the staff?"
"I certainly will," Mavis says. "They'll all miss you, of course, and they'll assume it's my fault you're leaving. The good news is I don't think they can hate me any more than they already do."
"They're Midwesterners," Irene says, "a bit resistant to change."
"You think?" Mavis says. "I tried to win them over with team building, lunches at Formosa, happy hour at the Clinton Street Social Club. But I'm pretty sure they talk about me behind my back the second I pick up the check."
"At least they see you," Irene says. Mavis cocks her head. She's not pretty exactly, but she's young, strong, and vibrant. She has presence. But someday, Mavis Key, too, will find herself leaving less of an impression. She'll be overlooked, shuffled aside, forgotten. Or maybe Irene is just bitter. She tries to regain the feeling she had as she stood on the bow of Huck's boat, but it's gone. She wants to go back down to the islands, she realizes then, if only so she can feel seen again.
"I'll come back for my things another time," Irene says. "On a Saturday, or after hours."
Mavis says, "Whatever you need, Irene, please ask me." She opens her arms, and Irene allows herself to be hugged.
I hope you figure this out.
Me too, Irene says.
Back at home, Irene sits at the kitchen table with her list in front of her. Death certificates, being pursued. Resignation, tendered. Obituary. Irene flips to the next page of her notebook and writes, Russell Steele died Tuesday, January 1st. He is survived by his wife of 35 years, Irene Hagen Steele, and his sons, Baker and Cashman Steele. Is that all? Irene can't mention his job at Ascension. She could maybe say that he worked for the Corn Refiners Association for 2 decades. She could mention Rotary Club and his years of service to the Iowa City School Board. She drops her pen, picks up her phone. She sends a text to her best friend, Dr. Lydia Christensen. Lydia, the first text says. Irene feels like she's falling backward in one of those outward-bound games where you're supposed to trust your comrades to catch you. Russ is dead. He died on New Year's Day, but I didn't find out until I got home from our dinner. The circumstances were so extraordinary and, honestly, so baffling that I didn't know how to tell you or anyone else. I'll call you later, I promise. Irene presses send. Okay, she thinks. It's officially out in the world. Unlike Mavis, Lydia is not a vault. A little while later, the doorbell rings. The doorbell is an antique, salvaged from a convent in Vicenza, Italy, and it makes quite a formal sound, somewhere between a gong and cathedral bells. Irene hurries down the hallway, hoping and praying it's FedEx with the death certificates, but knowing that, unless Paulette read Irene's mind before she left the voicemail, that's logistically impossible. It might be Lydia, though Lydia normally flings open the door and walks right in. Maybe Lydia called the Duns and the Kinseys, and this is the start of the onslaught. Bobby Kinsey will have pulled a casserole from her freezer or stopped by the Hy-Vee for a deli tray. Irene pauses before opening the door and takes a sustaining breath. She'll tell people the truth. Helicopter crash, Virgin Islands, work. But leave out the villa, the mistress, and Maya. Strong, beautiful Maya. Irene opens the door. It's not Lydia, and it's not Bobby. It's 4 men in dark suits, trench coats, and impractical shoes for the weather. The man in front, African-American, tall and broad, with a grim facial expression, flashes a badge. Irene Steele, he says. Irene is so stunned she can't speak. Is she being arrested? Are you Irene Steele? The man says. Is this the Steele residence? He glances above the doorframe, then down toward the corner of Lynn. 30 Church Street? Irene nods. Yes, it is. I am. Agent Kenneth Beckett, FBI, White Collar Crime Division. We have a search warrant for this address, if you'll kindly step aside. White Collar Crime. Irene steps aside. 3 of the agents start searching the house. Irene's instinct is to follow them, not to hide anything, but to make sure they're careful with her things. However, Agent Beckett wants to talk to Irene in private. She leads him into the amethyst parlor. It's chilly, and she offers to lay a fire. Just please sit down, Mrs. Steele, Agent Beckett says. He's stern and serious, like an FBI agent on television. Irene notices a black and gold knit cap sticking out of his briefcase. Iowa grad? She asks. I'm the class of 84.
Class of 91, Beckett says.
For a second, his eyes smile.
Go Hawks.
They aren't going to break anything, are they? Irene asks. This house? Well, it took me 6 years to renovate, and the antiques are real. There's a mural in the dining room. The moldings and trim have all been restored to period. The carpets... She stares down at Beckett's wet and icy wingtips on the Queen Victoria jewel box carpet. They'll be careful, right? Respectful? Quick nod.
We're professionals.
Of course.
Your husband was Russell Steele? Beckett says. Died January 1st in a helicopter crash off the coast of Virgin Gorda?
Yes.
And what did your husband do for a living, Mrs. Steele?
Irene briefly wonders if she needs a lawyer present. She tries to imagine Ed Sorley in his sweater vest dealing with these gentlemen. The idea is nearly laughable. The fact is, Irene has done nothing wrong. Irene has nothing to hide. He worked for a hedge fund called Ascension, Irene says.
What was his position there?
My understanding was that he was in customer relations. Beckett looks up.
Customer relations.
Not like he answered the phone and took complaints, Irene says. He wined and dined the clients, played golf, a lot of golf, made them comfortable. Russ was a very nice guy, non-threatening, friendly, engaging. He told a lot of corny jokes, asked to see pictures of your kids, remembered their names. Irene had been jealous at times of how good with people Russ was, how generous with his attention. All of their friends and acquaintances liked Russ better than her, and that was fine. Irene understood. They had their roles. Irene let Russ do the talking because he liked it and she didn't. She enjoyed quieter things, reading novels, cooking, nurturing one-on-one friendships, achieving goals in a timely and organized fashion, whether it was renovating a room in this house or putting an issue of the magazine to bed. She enjoyed fishing, the peace of being out on the water with a single, simple mission. Why is she thinking about fishing? Well, she knows why.
And where is this company Ascension based? Beckett asks.
Miami? Irene says. I'm not sure, though. Russ did a lot of traveling for work. He told me he was in Florida, Texas.
Told you?
Beckett says. Yes, Irene says. But I now have reason to believe he spent most of his time in the Virgin Islands. In St. John. Beckett scratches down a note. You know my husband owns property in St. John.
Yes, Beckett says. Federal agents are searching that house now.
Oh, dear, Irene says.
Beckett looks up. What?
I put my son Cash on a plane to St. Thomas this morning, Irene says. He'll arrive at the house in St. John sometime tonight.
Beckett nods. They should be finished with the search by then.
But if they're not?
They'll let him know and he can make other arrangements.
Huck, Irene thinks. Maybe he can stay with Huck for a night or two. Which is a crazy thought. Huck isn't family. He's merely a sort of friend. I guess I'm confused about what you're after. Is this part of the investigation about the helicopter?
Possibly related, Beckett says. Do you know a man named Todd Croft?
Russ's boss, Irene says. I met him once, December 2005, in the lobby of the Drake Hotel in Chicago. That was right before he offered Russ the job at Ascension. They knew each other at Northwestern, or at least that's what Russ said.
Do you have contact information for Mr. Croft? Beckett asks.
I don't. Mr. Croft's secretary, Marilyn Monroe, called here on the night of January 1st to tell me Russ had died. I've tried calling her back since then, but that number has been disconnected and the Ascension website is down. Beckett says,
Your husband made quite a good living, isn't that right?
Yes, Irene says, after he took the job with Ascension.
This house must have been expensive to renovate.
It was.
And how did you think your husband was earning so much money?
He worked at a hedge fund, Irene says. And I thought that provided a good salary. I didn't know about St. John. I didn't know about the other house.
You went down there recently, though, after he died?
Yes, that was my first time. We went for a week and returned home last Friday. My mother-in-law, Russ's mother, was failing. Now she's passed away, so I have that to deal with.
I'm sorry, Beckett says.
He looks at her again, this time more sympathetically. Would you like some tea, Agent Beckett?
No, but thank you.
I'd like some tea, Irene says. Is it all right if we go into the kitchen so I can make some? I mean, I'm free to move around the house, right?
Just stay where we can see you,
Agent Beckett says.
He rests his hands on his thighs and pushes himself to a stand.
Actually, some tea might warm me up.
Irene makes a pot of Lady Grey, and while she's at it, she prepares a tray of sandwiches and rinses two bunches of grapes. Agent Beckett accepts a ham and cheese and a cup of tea. An agent who looks like Tom Selleck pops into the kitchen to report that they have found nothing.
Did you remove or destroy any of your husband's papers or personal belongings after he died?
Beckett asks. I did not, Irene says. I searched through both this house and the house on St. John, looking for clues.
Clues?
What he was into, Irene says. Certainly, Agent Beckett, you realize that I think all this is suspicious as well. My husband was killed in a place I didn't know he was visiting. Then I found out he lived there. He owned property there. I was looking for answers.
What did you find?
A mistress, Irene thinks, a love child. Nothing, she says.
The youngest agent, a baby-faced ginger, pokes his head into the kitchen.
Nothing in the master bed or bath, he says.
He eyes the tray of sandwiches.
Are those for everyone?
Help yourself, Irene says. Then she thinks of something, a hiding place. She looks at Beckett, who is reviewing his notes as he eats his ham and cheese. No, she won't tell them. Maybe they'll find it, maybe they won't. Irene wonders if this investigation can work both ways. I called my real estate contact in St. John to request a death certificate. She blows across the surface of her tea. My family attorney here says that until I produce it, Russ is technically still alive. She pauses, waiting for a reaction, but none comes. Which would be quite something, because we've already scattered the ashes. Or what we thought were Russ's ashes. I never saw the body, and I wasn't consulted about the cremation until after it was a done deal. Is there any chance? I mean, do you think my husband might still be alive?
Beckett stands up to secure the door to the hallway and then the door to the dining room.
You've been very accommodating, he says, and we appreciate it. I'm sure you realize that we're here because we have reason to believe your husband had illegal business dealings. The one thing I can assure you,
Agent Beckett holds Irene's gaze,
is that your husband is dead.
He is, Irene says. Yes, he is. She knows this. She has been processing this news for over 2 weeks. And yet hearing Beckett say the words comes as a fresh shock. Irene's eyes sting with tears. The dreams were just that, dreams. But Irene must have been hanging on to a thread of hope. None of this added up. From the beginning, it felt like a hoax. The person who told Irene that Russ was dead, Marilyn Monroe, wasn't someone Irene had ever met face to face. Paulette had been professional to the point of seeming insensitive, nearly as if she was just going through the motions because she knew Russ would turn up eventually.
You're sure?
Yes, Beckett says. He must have definitive proof, Irene thinks, but he isn't sharing it. We're going to need your cell phone and your computer. They'll both be returned to you.
Yes, of course, Irene says. She pulls her cell phone out of her purse just as it lights up and starts chiming with a call from Lydia. Of course it's Lydia. Irene hits decline and hands it over. She nods at her laptop on the desk in the corner. When you say my husband had illegal business dealings, you mean Ascension had illegal business dealings, right? Todd Croft had illegal business dealings. I can tell you right now that Russ just wasn't the kind of person who would...
She notices the expression on Agent Beckett's face and stops talking. Russ wasn't the kind of person who would...
What?
Have a mistress, a secret daughter, and a 9-bedroom villa down in the Caribbean? It's pretty clear that Irene doesn't know what kind of person Russ was. She is as clueless as Ruth Madoff was. Irene remembers back when that news story broke. She had thought, of course the wife knew her husband was running a bazillion-dollar Ponzi scheme. How could she not know? But now that Irene is in a similar situation, she's certain Mrs. Madoff had no idea what was going on.
She probably spent all her time at the club lunching with her friends and meeting with her personal shopper. And if Ruth Madoff or Irene had asked her husband questions about his business, who's to say either woman would have been told the truth? Irene, for one, hadn't asked any questions. She had happily accepted the money Russ deposited into her renovation account and turned her attention to wallpaper and crown molding.
Are you looking for Todd Croft?
Barely a nod from Beckett. Not at liberty to say.
Yes, the answer was yes. He's drinking a daiquiri on some remote island without a name, Irene says.
That actually happens less than one would imagine, Beckett says. Men like Todd Croft can't just drop out of society. They're too power-hungry.
Beckett pops the last bite of sandwich into his mouth and polishes off his tea.
Don't worry, he'll turn up.
I did learn two things on my own, Irene says, that you might find helpful.
She's hesitant to hand over what she knows, but Russ's words have taken root inside of her. Irene is the only person I trust to do the right thing.
He probably meant the right thing for Rosie and Maya, but he most certainly also meant the right thing morally, which was to cooperate with the FBI, tell the truth, preserve her own integrity, protect the boys.
We have a bank account at Federal Republic. I have a statement I can give you. And the teller informed me that Russ made the last two deposits of $7,500 apiece in cash.
Irene searches Agent Beckett's face to see if this news startles him as much as it startled her, but he doesn't even blink. Of course, he's in the FBI. He has seen... Irene can't even imagine what.
And I asked my attorney, Edward Sorley, to find the account that Russ used to pay for this house when we bought it. He has a copy of a cashier's check drawn on a bank, MGST or something like that, in the Cayman Islands.
Agent Beckett's left eyebrow lifts a fraction of an inch.
Sounds about right, he says. Would you give me Mr. Sorley's contact information, please?
The FBI agents leave at 8:30 that night. As they're finally heading out the door, with far less evidence than they anticipated, Irene can tell by their dejected demeanors, she suggests that they go to the Wig and Pen for dinner.
Great wings, she says. My mother-in-law...
But she can't finish the sentence. Agent Beckett shakes her hand.
Thank you for your help today.
Irene finds herself uncharacteristically craving validation. She was helpful, right? They're aware from how cooperative and accommodating she's been, from the details she's shared, and from her general demeanor that she had no idea what Russ was involved with. She is innocent. She should not be held accountable. And yet she fears that she'll see these men again, storming her house in the pre-dawn hours with a warrant for her arrest. Their visit today has taken its toll. She's scared.
Will you be back tomorrow? She asks.
Someone will be by to drop off your phone and your computer, he says. Here's my card. Don't hesitate to call if you think of anything else you want to tell us.
Irene waits 10 minutes, then 15. When she's positive the agents are not coming back, she snaps off the porch light and heads for the library. The house phone rings, startling her. Should she answer? It's probably Cash, wondering why she isn't answering her cell phone. Well, honey, the FBI has it.
Irene?
Lydia, Irene says. She carries the phone into the library where she snaps on the Tiffany lamp and collapses in her favorite reading chair.
Hi.
I got your texts, Lydia says. But then you didn't answer when I called.
You can't be serious. Russ is not dead.
You would have told me right away if you'd found out he was dead. It was just hyperbole, right? You wish he were dead.
What did he do wrong? He was away somewhere, right?
The Virgin Islands, Irene says. The conversation feels like a hill she doesn't want to climb.
Where?
Did you tell me Russ was in the Virgin Islands? You didn't tell me that. I would have remembered. Irene closes her eyes. This is just as excruciating as she feared it would be.
She has made things far worse by waiting for so long. Lydia doesn't believe her. Irene should have called her right away. Irene should have brought her, or someone, in at the beginning. But she hadn't. It had been so sudden and so bizarre, so inexplicable. It was still inexplicable. And yet, here they are. Lydia, Irene says, Russ is dead. He was killed in a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands on January 1st. He was there on business. The rest of the details are too painful to share right now. His body was cremated, and the boys and I flew down to scatter his ashes. What? Lydia shouts. There's a muffled voice in the background. Brandon and I are on our way over right now. No, Irene says. Please, I was just heading up to bed. We'll talk tomorrow, I promise. She thinks for a second. Brandon who? Brandon, the barista, Lydia says. We're dating. We've been dating since that night. Irene supposes it's too late to ask Lydia to keep the news of Russ's death to herself. I'll call you tomorrow, really. I have to go. Okay, Lydia says. She sounds put out, and then she starts to cry. I'm so sorry, Irene. I'm sure you're destroyed. Russ was, well, you know he was the most devoted husband. Wasn't he just, Irene thinks. Good night, Lydia. She punches off the phone, sighs deeply, then turns her attention to the library shelves. Three shelves in from the right, three shelves down from the ceiling, Irene finds the Oxford English Dictionary that she lugged to college, Roget's Thesaurus, and Bartlett's Familiar Quotations in a solid scholarly stack. She moves the three massive tomes onto the brocade sofa and slides the panel out of the back of the shelf to reveal a secret compartment. And voila, there's a manila envelope stuffed full. Irene had forgotten all about the secret compartment until she started thinking about hiding places. The secret compartment had been original to this room, and even though the library had undergone a complete overhaul, Russ had insisted the compartment stay. It added character and history. They agreed it had probably been used to hide alcohol during Prohibition. It was one of the only aspects of the house Russ had taken a personal interest in. What will we hide in there? Irene had asked. Love notes, he'd said. She remembers that, clear as day. Love notes. She pulls out the manila envelope and empties the contents onto the coffee table. It's a stack of postcards secured with a rubber band. For one second, Irene holds out hope that the postcards are family heirlooms, maybe the correspondence that Millie conducted with Russ's father while he was away in the Navy. But once she wrangles the rubber band off, she sees the pictures on the postcards are all of St. John, Cinnamon Bay, Maho Bay, Francis Bay, Hanson Bay. None of the cards is addressed. On the back of each is a short, simple message. I love you. I'll miss you. You are my heart. I'll be here waiting. I love you, I love you, I love you. All of them are signed with the initials M.L. M.L.? Not Rosie? She thinks of Maya, but these notes feel almost certainly like declarations of romantic love. So they have to be from Rosie. M.L. must be a nickname. These are the love notes Russ was talking about then, years earlier, when he insisted they keep this compartment. Irene feels a wave of anger and disgust. He kept these in the house. But she also feels implicated. If she had to guess, she would say Rosie tucked these cards into Russ's luggage for him to find once he'd arrived home. Or maybe she slipped them into his jacket pocket as he was leaving. Instead of throwing them away, as Russ certainly knew he should, he'd kept them. He'd wanted, or needed, to save this proof that someone loved him, because so little love was shown to him at home. Irene has heard that love is a garden that needs to be tended. And what had Irene thought about that? She had thought it was sentimental nonsense, the stuff of sappy Hallmark cards. Love, for Irene, was a daily act. Steadfastness, loyalty, devotion. It was raising the boys, creating a beautiful, comfortable